The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Scleroderma, lupus, and dermatomyositis is presented by Dr. Howard Feinberg.
We're going to start today with systemic lupus erythematosus, mostly because I can guarantee you that disease will be on your boards. Systemic lupus is the most common of the autoimmune or collagen vascular diseases. The incidence varies with different populations and different ethnicities, so between 20 and 150 per 100,000. In the Chinese population, the U.S., African-American, black population, the incidence is about 400 per 100,000 in women, so about one out of every 250. So I can guarantee you, you're going to be seeing this. The peak age in the literature is between 17 and 40. Typically, the peak age for this disease is somewhere in their 20s for women. In peak ages, much more common in women. By the way, if you ever get asked a question about a rheumatic disease, is it more common in men or women, pick women. That's true for almost all of them. Gout, the spondyloarthropathies are an exception to that, but for the most part, it'll be women. 2 to 1 for older age groups or other age groups. One of the areas where people get tripped up with this is calling lupus. Lupus isn't a disease. The main disease in this category, systemic lupus erythematosus, but there are a bunch of other diseases with lupus in their name. In fact, there's 5 of them, which makes them great multiple choice questions. The first is subacute cutaneous lupus. That's a disease that has a non-fixed, non-scarring rash. These are typically women who get a photosensitive rash or an erythematous rash that will come and go. It's associated with a positive SSA antibody. It's treated with hydroxychloroquine, sunscreens, or with no treatment if it's relatively mild. Next is discoid lupus. Discoid lupus is also a skin-only disease that causes a scarring rash. It starts with an erythematous area and then develops a white atrophic area. If it's on the face or scalp, it can cause hair loss or be disfiguring. Usually these are relatively small lesions and again can be treated with hydroxychloroquine or if it's very mild can be left alone at times. The next one that's always on the list is lupus pernio, and that actually has nothing to do with this group of diseases. That's a variant of sarcoid that's associated with liver disease. It causes a violaceous, sometimes purpuric rash over the face and ears. It's sometimes mistaken for a malar rash and can be associated with an ANA, so is sometimes mistaken for a lupus. But this is sarcoid. It's associated with hepatic granulomas and liver involvement in sarcoid. And then we're going to spend some time on systemic lupus. And there's also drug-induced lupus. The first 4 on this list are the major diseases that, or the major drugs that are associated with drug-induced lupus. This is usually a milder form of systemic lupus. The ANA will be positive and can stay positive after the drug is withdrawn. Often it will become negative after about a year. It's associated with the antihistone antibody. This was on boards the last 2 years. If you see antihistone antibody, think drug-induced lupus. Typically, patients with this will not have renal or CNS involvement. It's not impossible, but it's rare with this disease. They'll also usually have normal complement levels. And I guess I'll get to the other slide afterwards. I also have a slide that lists all of the other drugs for you. Please, you don't have to memorize those. I put that up there for your information purposes. It's drugs that are definitely associated with drug-induced lupus that are suspected or possible. All right, we diagnose autoimmune diseases based on criteria. I have to apologize to you, but one of the problems this year is there are multiple criteria out there right now for systemic lupus. The criteria are going to be changing as of November of this year, but the newest criteria will not be on your boards. So I have those in there. I have the older criteria, the criteria that's currently in use. I really can't tell you for sure which one is going to be used or show up. I don't have access to your board questions. These are the old American College of Rheumatology criteria. They're still the ones that are recognized by the American College of Rheumatology. These actually predate me. The last big modification of these happened around 94. They were modified again previous to that in 88, back when I was a fellow, and actually had come out before that. You have to have four out of the list of 11. The first three are rashes: malar rash, photosensitive rash, and discoid rash. And then painless oral ulcers, arthritis, serositis, so either pleurisy or pericarditis, renal disease, neurologic involvement, which has now been defined as acute psychosis or seizures, hematologic, so either leukopenia, thrombocytopenia, or a hemolytic anemia. Anemia of chronic disease won't qualify. A positive ANA, and then any of the other weird lab tests that rheumatologists use. Four out of 11, you have the disease. Most of the world had moved to this group of criteria, including in the United States. This is the Systemic Lupus International Classification criteria. There's two options now to get the diagnosis. One is you have lupus nephritis and either a positive ANA or a positive anti-double-stranded DNA. Lupus nephritis on biopsy is what we call a full house. Everything lights up, IgG, IgA, IgM, complement, everything fluoresces when you're doing these biopsies. Any stage of lupus nephritis, positive ANA or anti-double-stranded DNA would count. Option two is you still have to have four criteria, but they're now divided into clinical criteria and immunologic criteria. The clinical criteria are varied from the original list. We have acute cutaneous lupus, which are the photosensitive rash, malar rash, all the non-scarring rashes that can occur with lupus. Chronic cutaneous lupus are scarring rashes. So that would include the discoid rash, but also several others that we see with lupus. We still have painless oral ulcers, and these are white aphthous ulcers that have typically no symptoms. Swelling or synovitis in two or more joints to qualify for arthritis, and then still serositis. Renal was changed. Anybody with more than 500 milligrams of protein or red blood cell cast qualifies. You no longer had to have a biopsy to be qualified under that. And neurologic, we defined as seizures, psychosis, myelitis, mononeuritis multiplex, acute confusional state, or cranial neuropathies. And then the hematologic options were all divided up. There are three separate criteria, and they cheated a little bit. They put those under clinical criteria, even though they're lab abnormalities. And then for lab, an ANA, DNA, anti-Smith antibody, anti-phospholipid, low complement levels, or direct Coombs without hemolysis. There is now a new American College of Rheumatology and European League Against Rheumatism set of criteria. These have been published. They're out in the literature. They were adopted in Europe. They will most likely be officially adopted by the College of Rheumatology this November. But they're already out in the literature and being used. Again, I don't expect this group to show up on your board, so this is more for your information. But you now, for the first time, have to have a positive ANA, and it has to be at least 1 to 80 or above, or you have to have another equivalent test to the ANA measuring anti-nuclear antibodies. And then you have to have at least one clinical domain and at least 10 points. And those criteria actually for all these diagnoses can occur over a period of years. So these are the clinical domains, and I'm just going to run through these quickly. Again, this is more for your information. I don't expect this group to be on boards this year. I hope none of you have to retake them again next year, but if you do, possibility that they'll show up then. So we have constitutional domain with fever. And then alopecia is back. It was taken out of the criteria in 1989, and now it's back again. Painless oral aphthous ulcers, subacute cutaneous or discoid is now one category, and acute cutaneous lupus, so other acute lupus rashes, a separate category. And then we still have arthritis. Neurologic, only three areas will now qualify. Serositis, still there. And then there's a separate hematologic, a separate renal, which is over 500 milligrams of protein in a 24-hour urine, or you'll have an automatic diagnosis if you have class 3 or 4 lupus nephritis. And then for immunologic, we have a whole bunch of different tests that we do for our lupus patients, each of which will qualify for points. The ANA is not included in that. You have to have that to start down the road for this criteria. All right, one thing very important to remember, this is a systemic disease. It can affect every part of the body. When students, residents come up to me and ask me a question, you know, Dr. Feinberg, can lupus do this? The answer is always yes. Lupus can do anything. So please remember that. The major things that they that can be catastrophic or that they tend to ask on boards are CNS, and anybody with a positive ANA who's meeting lupus criteria with seizures have to assume they have central nervous system lupus. For renal, anybody with significant proteinuria, you have to think, could this be renal involvement with their lupus? Those two used to kill a lot of women. Now, most of the time, we're successfully treating that and settling down the disease. And then the other one that I have on here, the cardiac manifestations, is a common board question and something really you should know clinically, and that's Lehmann-Sachs endocarditis. So lupus will cause arrhythmias. The most common abnormal arrhythmia for you to see in a higher proportion than what you'd see for the general population is supraventricular tachycardia. You will see atrial fib as the most common arrhythmia for all the autoimmune diseases just because it's the most common arrhythmia. And again, the most common one to be caused by these diseases, supraventricular tachycardia, and that's true for most of the autoimmune diseases. Lehmann-Sachs endocarditis looks like bacterial endocarditis with valvular changes. When you're actually looking at a valve, they look like small warts on the valve, and they can look like growths. It's part of the differential for bacterial endocarditis. These patients are immunocompromised. They sometimes have fevers as part of their disease. It can sometimes be confusing. I will tell you that I was walking down the hall. This happened to me about 3 years ago, and I had a thoracic surgeon call me over and say, hey, I just wanted you to know we're going to do valve replacement on one of your patients. They have endocarditis, and it was one of my lupus patients. It turned out to have Lehmann-Sachs endocarditis. The cultures were all negative. There was no bacteria. There was no infection. Person didn't need valve replacement. The treatment for that is usually to leave it alone unless it's affecting the chordae, compromising the valve itself. So please keep in mind, you can have something that looks like bacterial endocarditis in systemic lupus patients. It's Lehmann-Sachs endocarditis. It's a relatively benign problem, does not require specific treatment most of the time. It's a common question for boards. Okay, so this is the classes of lupus nephritis. If you have class 3 or 4 under the new criteria, you have systemic lupus. The treatment recommendations are different based on these classes. And this is current accepted treatment guidelines for systemic lupus erythematosus with renal involvement. The recommendations currently are every patient gets hydroxychloroquine, and that's true for every systemic lupus patient. They all get Plaquenil or hydroxychloroquine. They stay on it for life unless there's a specific reason to take them off. They stay on it through pregnancies. They stay on it through immunizations. If they have renal involvement, you add to that steroids, and then also your choice, cyclophosphamide or MMF, mycophenolate mofetil. Always have trouble pronouncing that one. MMF tends to be the primary drug that's being used at most centers now, but it does vary a little bit with populations and with preference. And these are the other treatments for systemic lupus. We treat their symptoms. If they're having photosensitivity, we use sunscreen. If their oral ulcers are rubbing against something and irritating them, we use the baby teething medicine for it. For their arthritis symptoms, we'll sometimes use non-steroidals, but the primary treatment is hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil. If that's not effective enough, we'll go to azathioprine or methotrexate, and then for renal involvement, cyclophosphamide or mycophenolate mofetil. All right, scleroderma, switching gears a little bit. Much less common disease. This occurs in under 1 out of 100,000 in the population. Peak age is roughly 40 years old. Again, more common in women than in men. If you don't remember anything about scleroderma, think what would happen to that part of the body, that organ, if it got thick and hard. If you can remember physiology and you think what happens if the area is thick and hard, you have an answer for scleroderma. It also has a number of variants like systemic lupus. There's a localized form, which is a relatively benign disease. It's associated with the anti-centromere antibody. The last year on boards, I was told that showed up, and it showed up with anti-centromere antibody, and if you remembered that, you got the question right, so please remember that one for me. There's two major forms, linear, which is just a band of scleroderma on the skin, and morphea, which is just a patch of scleroderma on the skin. There's also Kress syndrome, toxic scleroderma, which was also on boards last year, and progressive systemic sclerosis. Okay, I mentioned localized. Here's some pictures of it. This is just a band of linear scleroderma on the leg. The times when this is really important is if it's on the face and disfiguring, or if it's crossing a joint space and causing a contracture. Surgery, generally not a good idea to remove these. They tend to come back and be worse. So we use stretching, physical therapy. If it's crossing a joint space, mostly we leave these alone. All right, Kress syndrome. Although this is considered a part of localized scleroderma, most people look at Kress syndrome as an entity unto itself. Kress syndrome currently has diagnostic criteria. You have to have 2 out of 5 to have the disease. Each letter stands for something. I never remember what the term for a disease that has that is. But C is calcinosis, R, Raynaud's, E, esophageal motility, S, scleroderma or sclerodactyly. This usually affects primarily hands and feet. And T, telangiectasia. 2 out of 5 of those is Kress syndrome. Kress syndrome we used to think of as a much milder form of disease. We now know that patients with this will progress eventually and develop all of the problems that we see with progressive systemic sclerosis, but they do it over 20 years rather than over 4 or 5 years. Then we have toxic scleroderma, and I've talked about this at board review for a number of years, and it hadn't shown up, and I was thinking about taking it out, and then I was told last year, Schulman syndrome, diffuse fasciitis with eosinophilia was there. Good chance that it may pop up again since questions tend to be recycled. Toxic scleroderma is what it sounds like. It's a disease that's caused by a specific irritant. We know that in eosinophilia myalgia syndrome caused by L-tryptophan, you can get rashes, fevers, arthralgia. You can also get scleroderma skin changes. That's been associated with a form of L-tryptophan that was contaminated with E. coli. It was illegal in the United States for a period of years. It's back in the United States now, so another contaminated group, and we may see it again. And then rapeseed oil-related disease. Rapeseed oil was imported from Spain as a gourmet cooking oil. It's used as a cheap substitute in Europe for olive oil, for people who didn't want to spend the money or couldn't afford olive oil, but it hit all the gourmet stores, was in fashion for a while. Large amounts of rapeseed oil can cause scleroderma skin changes. And signs of systemic sclerosis as well. That also was taken off the market in the United States, but has also been back for 5 or 6 years now. So again, if it becomes a hot fashion item again, we may start seeing scleroderma as a result of it. And then the one that did show up on boards, it's one of my favorites because my wife's maiden name is Schulman, so I have to remember Schulman syndrome. Diffuse fasciitis with eosinophilia. This is a fairly uncommon disease. I loved weird and strange diseases and rare diseases. That was my whole practice for a lot of years. So I figured I'd see some of that. I went over 20 years without seeing a case, and then one walked into my office, a young high school football player. This is a disease where after heavy aerobic type of exercise, you get inflamed skin, and then it becomes thick, hard, and you get a patch of what looks like scleroderma developing over the area. And this was a high school football player, and when he was going to his workouts for his team, his skin would get inflamed on his side, and he got a patch of scleroderma developing. Every time he went to a workout, it got worse. The treatment for it is to avoid aerobic exercise. So for those of you who, like me, don't like doing a lot of exercise, good disease to have. You then have an excuse not to do your exercise. Schulman syndrome. All right, and then the main disease in this category, progressive systemic sclerosis. This is a disease that makes things thick and hard. So we get pulmonary fibrosis, cardiac fibrosis, renal artery fibrosis, which can cause accelerated hypertension. The treatment for that is to use an ACE inhibitor. We now know that the mortality rate for this disease is higher if you put people on an ACE inhibitor beforehand. So we do not recommend that as a routine treatment for hypertension with these patients. If they start developing accelerated hypertension, give them an ACE inhibitor. They can go into renal crisis. These patients, this is usually a fatal disease. The life expectancy was 4 years. We're now out to about 7 years. Most patients with this will succumb. The primary cause is pulmonary hypertension, renal failure, and cardiac fibrosis in these patients. There are criteria. These are the American College of Rheumatology accepted criteria. Skin thickening of the fingers of both hands proximal to the MCP joints gets you 9 points. You need 9 points to make the diagnosis. So if they have skin thickening that extends from the fingertips and progresses past the MCP joints, they have progressive systemic sclerosis. If they have only distal involvement, think Kress syndrome, but also look for these other criteria. One is abnormal nail fold capillaries or signs of organ involvement, pulmonary hypertension, and then other autoantibodies for the disease. The treatment that's most in fashion right now is mycophenolate mofetil. We haven't had great success with any of the treatments for this disease. Penicillamine was an old one. Now it's relegated to a little paragraph in the textbooks. We use steroids. Methotrexate was used for a while. It was one of the more popular treatments. Lately, literature showing it's really not effective. We use cyclophosphamide for the interstitial lung disease. It's effective in a percentage of those patients. Then a whole bunch of other therapies. The most effective therapies we really have are treating the sequela of these diseases. So we're using cyclophosphamide for interstitial lung disease and in patients who are developing progressive fibrosis. We treat pulmonary hypertension with drugs aimed at pulmonary hypertension directly. We treat accelerated hypertension with ACE inhibitors. We don't really have great effective therapies for this disease. Okay, next group, idiopathic inflammatory myopathies. This is a huge group of diseases. It's actually a lot of different diseases, including polymyositis, dermatomyositis, inclusion body myositis, malignancy-associated myositis, antisynthetase antibody syndrome. So we've got a bunch of diseases to go through. I'm going to kind of group them together for you because we do have limited time and talk about as many of these components as we can. The ACR and the European League Against Rheumatism have developed new criteria in 2017 with these diseases, by the way, called idiopathic inflammatory myopathies. That's the IIM. So if you have a score of 5.5 without a biopsy, 6.7 with a biopsy, you have probable. A score of 7.5 or 8.7, you have definite. I don't really recommend you go out and memorize these criteria. In fact, I'm not trying to memorize these criteria, and I deal with these types of diseases all the time. This is the reference for you, for anyone who wants to look them up. And this is the reason why I'm saying don't remember them. Unless you're a lot better with numbers than I am, figuring out which one is 1.3, 0.7, 1.5, and the numbers are all over the place, it's really tough. So I just pull up the chart when I need them and look at them. I'm going to give you a different way of identifying these diseases for your board questions. For epidemiology, numbers are a little less than 1 out of 1 million in the general population. I've always thought those numbers really underestimate the incidence. I had quite a few patients with this in my practice, and I wasn't taking care of a population of 50 million. But the published incidence is actually 0.6 per million for the United States. More common, again, in women than in men. There's a pediatric group with this, but for our purposes, peak age is around 50 years old. So about the same age as we see for the rheumatoid arthritis population. Polymyositis, so to diagnose this, you have proximal muscle weakness, hip and shoulder girdle muscle weakness, no pain. They may complain of soreness in the muscles from overuse, but the disease itself does not cause pain. No rash, that would be dermatomyositis, and a high CPK. And typically the CPKs for this are not 300, 400, 600. The CPKs for this are 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, and 10 or 20,000 would be a much more typical number. So if you see a CPK of 500, 600 on your boards, think of metabolic myopathy or another disease, or they're trying to trick you. See a CPK of 15,000, you may want to think about this disease. To diagnose this, we see proximal muscle weakness, a real high CPK. We do an EMG nerve conduction study that shows a typical pattern, and then a muscle biopsy. Put all of those together to make the diagnosis. If they have that disease and they have a rash, then they have dermatomyositis instead. The typical rashes are heliotrope rash, which is redness over the eyelids, Groton's papules, which I have illustrated down at the bottom, kind of white raised areas, sometimes red areas over the knuckles on the hands. Last year, they had a V-sign and mechanics hands on boards. So a V-sign is, if you're wearing a V-neck shirt, the area of skin that gets exposed, that would turn red. That's the V-sign. Shawl sign is if you take a woman's shawl, put it over your shoulders, the area that would be covered by it would turn red. That's the shawl sign. And mechanic's hands are just what it sounds like. All the lines and grooves in the hands get hyperpigmented, so it looks like there's grease stuck in the grooves in the hands. That's mechanic's hands. So dermatomyositis, same thing as polymyositis, but with a rash. There are also a number of non-muscle manifestations, big ones, subcutaneous calcium deposits, interstitial lung disease, cardiac muscle involvement with the disease. And then we have inclusion body myositis. Inclusion body myositis will look like polymyositis or dermatomyositis, but there are inclusion bodies seen on electron microscopic evaluation of the muscle biopsies. It tends to be familial and is refractory to treatment. So you get a history that parent had it, child had it, there's two other people in the family had it. Think inclusion body myositis, look for electron microscopic or results on a biopsy. And then malignancy associated. So malignancy associated is either polymyositis or dermatomyositis with cancer. These diseases can be a paraneoplastic process. You don't want to miss that. Anybody with polymyositis or dermatomyositis should be screened for cancer. All women should be checked for ovarian cancer. The only type of cancer that has a much higher incidence with this disease than what you'd expect for the population you're dealing with is ovarian cancer. So please remember that one. All women with this get screened for ovarian cancer. What we do, if we're dealing with 50-year-olds, they get a colonoscopy, they get a chest x-ray, we do a CT of the abdomen and pelvis, we look for cancers on all of these patients. If they relapse, you look again. If they have polymyositis, then develop a rash, you rescreen them. And this can be a paraneoplastic disease. It can occur when the cancer is still at a one cell level, so you may not be able to find the cancer initially. Please keep in mind cancers can be associated with this. All right, so these are the more complicated versions of the inflammatory myopathies, but antisynthetase syndrome showed up on boards last year also. So about 20% of the polymyositis or dermatomyositis patients will have extra lab tests be associated with interstitial lung disease and mechanic's hands. So if they give you a case of polymyositis or dermatomyositis with lung involvement, possibly cardiac involvement, mechanic's hands, Raynaud's phenomenon, think this disease, it's associated with antisynthetase antibodies. The main one is JO1 antibody. I have a list of them later on for you in my slides. And then this entity, signal recognition particle antibody-associated myopathy. These are people with really severe polymyositis, with cardiac or heart muscle involvement, who have a positive signal recognition particle antibody. It's about 4% of the cases. We're almost there. And then the last disease in the group that I'm really going to hit, amyopathic, and these are patients who have skin manifestations of dermatomyositis, no muscle weakness, and a normal CPK. Your major differential for this is going to be subacute cutaneous lupus or amyopathic dermatomyositis. They may have a photosensitive rash, malar-looking rash, just an erythematous rash, one of the dermatomyositis rashes. They may or may not have a positive ANA. They may or may not have fatigue. In the case of amyopathic dermatomyositis, it's due to abnormal ATP in the muscles, and you can get that by doing enzymatic studies of ATP and muscle biopsies. again, for diagnosing the idiopathic inflammatory myopathies, this whole group, weakness in the typical pattern, elevated CPK, abnormal EMG nerve conduction study, abnormal biopsy. They have a rash, they have dermatomyositis. If they have cancer, they have malignancy associated. If they have JO1, they have anti-synthetase antibody syndrome. If they have anti-particle recognition antibodies, they have that form of the disease. And again, I've listed all of the antibodies for you just so that you'll have a list of the different antibodies, ANA seen in about 60% of these patients. Okay, treatment, the expense of running over for a few seconds. They all get high-dose steroids. The ones that can't tolerate them or aren't responding quickly or you don't want to keep them on high-dose steroids, we sometimes use methotrexate and immunosuppressive therapy. All of the familial patients get immunosuppressive therapy. All the anti-synthetase antibody syndrome patients get immunosuppressant therapy. So I'm going to continue with one quick disease, polymyalgia rheumatica. I have to talk about this because I did a lot of research with this disease back in the early 90s. Polymyalgia rheumatica is the opposite. Oh, here he is. If you want to come up, I think you were next. Has the opposite problem of the idiopathic inflammatory myopathies. Those are proximal muscle weakness without pain. This is proximal muscle pain without weakness, much more common disease. They have hip and shoulder girdle muscle pain. It's associated with giant cell arteritis or temporal arteritis, which you heard about during the vasculitis talk.